You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 24th of April 2015 on Monocle 24.
Welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Emma Nelson. On today's show, the US apologises for killing two hostages during a strike in Pakistan aimed at Al-Qaeda.
I profoundly regret what happened. On behalf of the United States government, I offer our deepest apologies to the families.
I'll be discussing the US and its drone policy with my studio guests Roger Boys and Samira Shackle. Also ahead, 2 weeks before a general election in the UK, the candidates battle it out over foreign policy.
I've learnt as Prime Minister that it is so important in a dangerous and uncertain world that you show clarity, consistency and strength on these foreign policy issues.
We'll examine why all of a sudden David Cameron and the like have decided to look beyond Britain's shores. Plus, HSBC considers leaving the UK at the same time as it warns the UK against leaving the EU. International removals firms are standing by their phones. All that and more on this edition of Midori House with me, Emma Nelson. A very warm welcome to the programme. We'll devote the next half hour to looking at some of the day's stories in depth. My studio guests today, Roger Boys, the diplomatic editor of the Times of London, and the journalist Samira Shackle. Welcome both to the programme. Now, the intelligence was lacking, so was communication, and as a result, American development expert Warren Weinstein and the Italian aid worker Giovanni Loporto lost their lives after years as captives of the Al-Qaeda militants in Pakistan. They were killed by a drone strike led by the US. The US has apologised. President Obama says he takes full responsibility. Well, let's hear what Raffaella Pantucci from the Royal United Services Institute had to say on the drone strikes.
It is a policy that the United States has been deploying in terms of dealing with terrorist threats. We'd had an issue recently with an individual case of an American national who was associated with Al-Qaeda, who was actually arrested out in these sort of tribal areas rather than hit with a drone strike. And he was brought back and is currently facing a sort of American trial. And that case, I think, is interesting because it showed people that there is a way of getting these people back. And so rather than using drone strikes, which, you know, are a very blunt tool, there are other ways of trying to sort of counter terrorism and deal with these sorts of situations.
That was Raffaella Pantucci there from RUSI talking about an alternative to perhaps to the policy employed by the United States of using drones on Al-Qaeda and the like in Pakistan. Roger Boys, we'll return to what Raffaella had to say in a few moments' time. But first and foremost, this policy on drones was reshaped by Obama. So this, the deaths of these two men come straight back to his doorstep, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. In fact, I was when he got the Nobel Prize, I was there in Oslo in the Grand Hotel when he was sort of dancing afterwards. And he got it, and the speech was all about humane warfare. That's to say, about the need to withdraw from wars, but also to wage war humanely. And it turned out this meant basically drones. It meant robots replacing men. And I think that's a very disappointing and actually ultimately irresponsible way of waging war, because if you take the human out of war, then you're going to lose accountability, and you're also going to lose judgment. And that's what's happening largely. Drones, it seems to me, obviously to Obama and the Pentagon, are quite acceptable as surveillance instruments, although even that's unnerving for lots of these states or semi-states. When you target them with the dependent on human intelligence gathering, then you're going to make mistakes, and you're going to make a lot of mistakes. And they've made a lot of enemies in Pakistan. They've made a lot of enemies in Yemen simply through this device.
Roger just mentioned there the idea of the United States making enemies in Pakistan. Samira, your area of expertise is Pakistan. You travel there widely. What surprised me, or no, perhaps did not surprise me, is that we witness accounts of Al-Qaeda operatives being killed by drone strikes, and that makes one line in a news bulletin. As soon as it is one of their own, the United States, suddenly there is a willingness to rediscuss all this. And Obama has said that they will actually re-examine what happened.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that we always see that kind of double standard. I think often when we're discussing the impact of Western foreign policy overseas, it's often the case that it sort of takes an incident like this when it affects one of our own, as you put it, to bring it back onto the agenda. I think it was quite interesting that the Pakistani government issued a statement expressing their sympathy with the families of the two hostages who were killed and saying that they are well aware of the unintended consequences of drone strikes and sort of using it to highlight the deaths of many Pakistani civilians. So I think that, you know, while that may be quite opportunistic, given that there's quite clear evidence that points anyway, the Pakistani authorities have tacitly allowed these strikes to go ahead. I think that, that you know, it does illustrate that double standard is there, and it does take something like this to put it back on the agenda. And certainly there's a big backlash amongst the public in Pakistan, as there is in Yemen, the sort of widespread anger about the deaths of civilians, about the violation of sovereignty, about all of those things. And I think probably the lack of transparency about the drones program adds to that, because, you know, it is quite a complicated issue. There's the whole argument that deaths are lower than in conventional warfare. There's also the fact that from travelling in Pakistan, interestingly, some people from the areas closest to where these strikes go ahead actually quite support them, because they just want to get rid of the militant threat. So it's a complicated picture, and I think the lack of transparency only adds to that backlash.
You mentioned the possible tacit agreement by the Pakistani authorities to allow these drones to be sent over and do what they needed to do in the eyes of the United States. But there is perhaps the argument that these two men had been captives for several years, and there was a failure by Pakistan, one could argue, to find these men.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the Pakistani state fails on all sorts of measures, not least on getting kidnapped victims back. I mean, I think that it's not just Americans. I mean, but there aren't actually that many foreigners in Pakistan, partly because of the security situation. And there's huge numbers of Pakistani citizens kidnapped and held. I mean, I've got a family friend who was held by the Taliban for 6 months in Waziristan, and it was a case of the family making the effort to get him out. The state doesn't really intervene that much, and is a weak enough body that it's not capable of intervening that much. You've got the sons of two quite senior politicians have been held now for respectively, I think, 18 months and a year. So this goes up to the very highest levels. I mean, even the children of very influential people still being held hostage. So I think that's the context in which we should see their failure to get them back.
So in that context, Roger, there is still a very powerful argument for the United States to deploy drones over Pakistan to get a job done that the local authorities simply cannot or perhaps will not do.
Yeah, I don't quite like that phrase, get a job done.
There is that deeply sort of slightly sinister clinical element to the whole thing.
Well, it's the dehumanisation of the thing. I think the problem, I don't think actually it's just the drones that are the problem. If you look at how he dealt with Osama bin Laden, you have a similar situation. You use human intelligence you test it, you're patient, you go in, and then you kill him. Yeah, it seems to me using your SEALs as a kind of drone substitute in a way, instead of the drones as a human substitute. And it seems to me it's seen as a triumph for Obama. It seems to me it was one of the cardinal errors. He should have been, if it was possible to take Obama out, and naive as it sounds, put him on trial. Or at least expose him to some kind of justice, then we would have won much more. And I think it's the same with the drones, that we're not getting the job done by blowing up people with the very vaguest, sometimes the very vaguest of targeting options. I don't think that's quite how it should be.
You were nodding in agreement, Samir.
Yeah, I just think that the levels of civilian deaths alone, I think, make an argument against it, because you have the defense from the US authorities saying, well, we kill very, very few civilians, it's negligible how many civilians we kill, etc. But actually, I think that the fact that these two hostages were killed in January and it's taken until now, April, end of April, to confirm their identities shows that they actually don't really know who they're killing. So a lot of the time, because they don't have that reliable on the ground intelligence, because the human element's been taken out of it, it's sort of guessing based on algorithms, which is quite a horrifying way of ending lives. You know, it's sort of killing people because on the assumption that, well, there is X number of men gathering at X time of day, therefore it must be a group of militants, let's kill them. And then they don't go on the sort of civilian list of casualties, they go on the militant list of casualties. Well, who's to say those people were militants? And that, I think, has a pretty radicalising effect on the wider population.
It is, it must be said, however, an incredibly difficult balance to strike. I mean, just listening to what Raffaella Pantucci had to say a few moments ago, there is that issue that, yes, one American national was captured in Pakistan and brought back to the United States. That is one success story that requires a significant amount of human intelligence gathering. Plus the fact there is what I think what Raffaella has described as the badlands of Pakistan, where there is the knowledge that there are Al-Qaeda figures out there, but there isn't the precise knowledge of who they are and exactly what they are doing. Unfortunately, the argument is always going to be that a drone is probably going to be the best way to do that, and the casualties are just going to have to be accepted, which is
I think it's a complicated picture, definitely, because, and you know, as I was saying earlier, the death toll is lower than conventional warfare, perhaps, and I think that, you know, conversely, that there are signs that it's had some high profile targets, that it has affected the leadership structures of the Pakistani Taliban. It's affected them to the extent that there's sort of internal fracturing around leadership after senior leaders being killed off and so on. But I think probably what both Roger and I are getting at is just that anything that, or this is what I've taken from the discussion anyway, anything that so significantly lowers the threshold at which you can enter war should be profoundly worrying for everyone everywhere, I think.
Roger, how great an appetite do you believe there to be within the United States for the continuation of the drones as they are? Indeed, is there an appetite to reconsider their role?
I don't think there's any appetite. No, I think for ending the drone program, you mean? I don't think so, no. It basically reduces risk to Americans to zero. That's the first thing. The main focus of criticism for the drone program within the United States is about secrecy. And secrecy has become very pivotal for the whole drone program. As a result, the administration, of course, says intelligence sources, you would expose too much and you would enter a danger zone. But the result is, it's pretty awful, really. It's what happens is you kill people, you say they're Al-Qaeda operatives, and you've got no way of proving it. You're not under any obligation by a court to prove that these are Al-Qaeda operatives. You've only got a picture, a screen grab from a guy's screen in Nevada. And I worry about that kind of warfare.
Let us move on to the UK general election. You mentioned a moment ago, Roger, that there's very little appetite for people to reassess the role of drones outside the United States or within the United Kingdom. There has, in recent years, been a terrible, terrible lack of appetite for foreign policy. And that perhaps has been reflected in the way that the general election campaign has been structured, because we are but 2 weeks from the general election here in the United Kingdom. And until today, those campaigning to govern this blessed plot, these little islands, have kept things well and truly insular in their most literal sense. Things changed, however, in the past few hours. A speech was given by the opposition leader, Ed Miliband, in which it was said that he was appearing to accuse the current government of failing to stop the migrant problem in the Mediterranean because of failure of post-conflict planning in Libya. The Conservatives have understandably not been very, very pleased. Samira, what's been your reaction to the way that foreign policy has been debated in the election campaign today?
I think it's quite interesting because I think given how strongly anti-immigration the whole tone of the general election campaign and indeed politics for the last couple of years has been, I think that the series of migrant deaths in the Mediterranean was probably quite a disaster for the main political parties. He probably didn't know quite how to handle it because you don't really have anyone in the mainstream, certainly not Conservatives or Labour, making that sort of positive case for immigration, or indeed very strongly making the argument about the sort of humanitarian need and the sort of international rights of asylum seekers and so on. That's simply not a popular issue with the electorate. So I think that sort of shifting that discussion away from saying we should open our doors, we should sort of comply with our obligations, our humanitarian obligations or whatever, Ed Miliband sort of twisted it around to talk about post-war planning, which is probably the first time that post-conflict planning has become an electoral hot issue. But I think that it's sort of looking at that as a way, I would imagine, a way around talking about this issue of what we do about asylum seekers and what we do when there is a huge humanitarian need, which is not something that plays particularly well with the electorate.
Roger, it was indeed a very strange approach to take by Ed Miliband to sort of go in the post-conflict planning policy for Libya when there have been arguably some much, much more immediately pressing foreign policy issues associated, you know, that the coalition has had to deal with in the last couple of years.
Well, I think this speech was prepared long before the people were drowned crossing the Mediterranean. And he's basically snatched this particular subject because he's understood, first of all, that it actually is emotionally moving the electorate. And because it sort of feeds a Labour message, which is that the immigration problem is much more nuanced than is being presented by certainly by UKIP and also by the Conservatives. So he's kind of hijacked his own speech. But the truth is, it was stupid, really, because it's clear. I mean, frankly, Labour and Conservative are agreed on three things. One is that we don't like people drowning. The other is we don't really want them over here. And the third thing is that there's really nothing we can do about it except sort out Libya, and we don't know how to do that. So it was always a losing wicket, really, for Miliband. He didn't come up with any solutions. And to sort of retroactively blame Cameron when Labour was actually silent all those years anyway about what to do after we got rid of Gaddafi gets you nowhere, and actually exposes him as a bit of a whiner rather than as a statesman in waiting, which is what he really wanted to use that speech to show.
He does say that he is ready, doesn't he? That was a thing that Ed Miliband said, and he wants to be the statesman in waiting, and he seems to be almost puffing his chest out a little bit as if he is the statesman in waiting. He's convinced himself, at least. It's funny, though, that the foreign policy has been brought back to how much of a threat from abroad there is to the United Kingdom. This almost seems to be the thing that is knitted through every single argument over the UK and its politics. There is very little discussion, though, about the idea of the way that the coalition has acted within, let's say, Europe, or how it has or has not taken active participation in the conflict in Ukraine, which is what a lot of the rest of the world is blaming. Is saying that the United Kingdom has been desperately inactive in.
Yes, that's absolutely right. But Russia is quite a sensitive subject for Labour, so it tries to avoid this, avoid the theme. It's sensitive because there are all sorts of sensitive areas, actually, foreign policy areas for the Labour Party, and there are no votes in foreign policy. So as a result, you get very niche, very tribal arguments. So there's one tribal argument within the Labour Party about having dialogue with Russia or not having dialogue with Russia. And there are some people in the Labour Party who think that sanctions should be scaled back in some way and that diplomacy should be given a chance, and who are complaining that Cameron has lost his place on the high table along with Hollande and Merkel in negotiating with Putin. But there is another wing of the Labour Party which is very much for human rights in Russia, and they're being actually swamped by Ed's absolute determination to prepare himself for some government in which he will actually deal with Putin. They're all calculus. Miliband, he may be delusional, but he thinks that in 3 weeks' time he's going to be the Prime Minister of Britain and he's going to be dealing with Russia. So he's actually discounting some of the criticism of Russia that would normally come out in party discourse, and holding himself back. So there's Russia, there's the whole question of intervention, military intervention, toxic subject for Labour because of Blair, Blair's invasion. It splits the party still, the whole question of whether one should be militarily involved at all. So he has to fudge it. He has to find different ways of papering over the fact that he blocked an intervention in Syria in 2013, for example.
I mean, before we go to the break, briefly, Samira, the former Foreign Secretary William Hague has said that foreign policy is not something you can discover 13 days before the election. This is really something that voters don't care about.
Yeah, I guess that's true. It is something. I thought that Hague's comments more generally just seem to be saying sort of, well, why didn't you say anything at the time if it was such a big deal? But I think that that is also a point that the electorate doesn't really seem to care that much about it. And I think, though, also that taken out of the context of election campaigning and scoring points or whatever it is, that I think Miliband does raise quite a good point about post-conflict planning, and that's been something we've successively failed on over the years.
You're listening to Midori House, here with me, Emma Nelson, Samira Shackle and Roger Boys. Join me too. Up next, why is HSBC mulling over an exit from the United Kingdom?
From the streets of Kabul to a girls' school in the shadow of the Hindu Kush, London-based artist George Butler spent 3 weeks in Afghanistan, reporting on life in the war-torn country through that most old-fashioned of methods, paper and ink.
This is in Herat, and as always, I just picked a spot that I thought I could describe what I was witnessing as best as I could. It's very much that balance in Afghanistan of how long it's safe to be there, but also that drive to try and describe to people what it's like in a place that is almost always described as dangerous or unsafe.
Art of War, a Monocle film, now playing on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. I'm Emma Nelson, still with me, Roger Boys and Samira Shackle. Now, a moment ago we were discussing foreign policy, well, its absence from the election campaigns of the main parties. Well, in a roundabout way, let's continue with the election, because a banking giant, HSBC, is considering leaving the United Kingdom if the United Kingdom decides to leave the EU. The tighter rules and regulations post-2008 haven't helped either. Roger Boys, how much do we care about HSBC wanting to up sticks and relocate?
Well, I mean, my instinct is to say, you know, good riddance, really. But there are 40,000 jobs involved, so I suppose some people will say, please stay. It's you know, it's got an extremely tarnished reputation. You know, if you started to look for the kind of places where it could relocate, you'll find that most of them don't want them. In Switzerland, they're, you know, endless criminal cases against HSBC underway at the moment. The truth is, it's part of an election, a subunit of the British election campaign, which is how does the Labour Party drum up support that demonstrates that business is very much against a European referendum and certainly against British exit from the European Union. And HSBC is playing that game, perhaps wanting some kind of offer or some kind of reassurance, saying that, you know, that they're loved and so on. But it's a game that's not going to work, I think. It's a losing wicket for Labour, because actually all its other policies, apart from staying in Europe, are regarded very critically by business, corporation tax. You know, there's endless things that worry the business community. The truth is, whatever they say, London is actually a very good place still to do business because of the global timings, but also because of the regulation.
So Miriam, I mean, just listening to what Roger had to say there in terms of the who cares element and the fact that HSBC said no, this has got nothing. The timing of this report has got nothing to do with the fact that we want to pressurise the Conservatives to make sure that they will back staying in the EU. Whatever response any political party gives to this is really going to be incredibly sensitive because, as we've seen just from Roger's immediate reaction, we don't like banks in the United Kingdom. You know, businesses might do, but the people who put the X's in the boxes in the polling booths in 2 weeks' time really still hate the banks.
Yeah, I think that's true. They're not very popular, are they? And I think that my instinctive reaction is just the same as Roger's. You sort of think, well, who cares, really, good riddance. And but, you know, there is the fact that it's 48,000 people are employed and so on. So, as you say, it's sensitive. So you wouldn't really have politicians sticking two fingers up. But I think that they're sensitive about backing them because of these. I think nothing throws into greater relief the unpopularity of bankers than the fact that there's these numerous criminal cases against HSBC, one of our biggest banks.
Well, let's have a look. Finally, the Sustainable Development Solutions Network for the United Nations, and not normally a headline grabber, one would argue. However, it's published its list of the top 10 happiest places on Earth to live. Well, we're no great fans of a top 10 here on Monocle 24, but we do like the nation that topped the poll, Switzerland. Roger, are you happy that the Swiss are doing it better than anyone else?
Yeah, and of course, I'm notably sceptical about happiness indices. I know Monocle likes to do its measurements too, although I'm sure more scientifically than this one. I think if I were an Algerian immigrant in Switzerland, I wouldn't be voting for Switzerland as the happiest place in the world. I think there are quite a lot of unhappy people in Switzerland. I think there are a lot of Swiss soldiers with guns in their cupboards who end up shooting themselves. I think I don't know how to measure. If you just measure it in terms of quality of hot chocolate and stuff, yes, it deserves to win. It deserves to be happy. It's got mountains. It's got fresh air. It's got goats. What more do you want? Well, I think there has to be something else to be sustainably happy.
Samira, your reaction? I mean, we have Switzerland at number one, followed by Iceland, and then Denmark, which was top spot last year, but has been knocked off, which is a shame, because I think anyone who's ever been to Copenhagen will find it a nice place.
I'm sure they're all very nice places. I think, these indices always feel quite arbitrary, I think, but I guess the kinds of things they're going for are like the balance, aren't they? Work-life balance. And I think that's probably the reason the UK might not feature quite so highly, or maybe just because we love a whinge, so we don't self-report very well.
We had the Monocle Quality of Life conference was held in Lisbon last week, and one of the key speakers was Eric Speakerman, the art historian and sort of very, very famous topographer. And he was asked where was his favourite place, and he said that he couldn't think of one great place. He would quite like Denmark, but with the climate of southern Italy. I mean, anyone who's ever seen the sky in Copenhagen will understand what he's trying to say. Roger, you can live wherever you like in the world, and you can make an amalgamation of beautiful places if you wish. Where is your quality of life top spot?
Well, I think a bit of Birmingham.
Right, I have to stop you right there.
A bit of Minsk.
I know Birmingham like the back of my hand. Which bit?
Ah! I was bluffing, to be honest. I was bluffing. What I meant was happiness comes from inside. It doesn't matter what street you live in and what mountaintop you're yodeling from.
Oh, how lofty. And Samira, Minsk and the A435 through King's Heath High Street, notwithstanding, where are you going to plant your feet?
I quite like London, actually. I know that's not popular. People have obviously lots of complaints about the property prices and weather and everything, but, you know, I like it.
It's not so bad, is it? Thank you very much indeed, Samira Shackle and Roger Boyce, for joining us here on Midori House. That's all we have time for today's programme. My thanks to our producer, Ben Ryland, and our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Mike Huin was our researcher too, and our studio manager was Toby Hammond. For the next half hour, Ben Ryland will leap out from behind the glass to the control room and keep you company with Monocle's international playlist. Then at 1900 hours, Marcus Hippie will be here to bring you the menu, our food programme, and at 2200 hours, I'll return with with the Monocle Daily. My co-presenter will be Dominic Reynolds. This show will be back at the same time on Monday at 1800 hours London time. But for now, from this edition of Midori House, from me, Emma Nelson, it's goodbye. Thank you for listening and have a great weekend.